You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Although the Second City isn't doing in-person shows, classes, or events, we're doing all of those things virtually. Head over to secondcity.com and you can sign up for a class. We've got really affordable drop-in classes where you might be improvising with people from other countries. We're doing corporate workshops and events. And we have a whole new slate of virtual shows that you can get tickets to. Get more comedy in your life by going to secondcity.com. Welcome to the world of Tony Ho from CBC Podcasts. It's an award-winning, bite-sized narrative comedy series about human relationships, familiar, hilarious, and sometimes unnerving. The troupe features Miguel Rivas, Adam Niebergall, and alumnus of the Second City mainstage, Roger Bainbridge. They will take you on a darkly comedic ride that finds honesty in every situation. You can listen and subscribe to Tony Ho on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Wow, I really enjoyed my conversation with Chad Sanders. He's a writer, director, actor, and musician who's based in New York City. Previously, he had a corporate life. He worked at Google and YouTube as a tech entrepreneur. He's written and co-written TV series and feature films with collaborators like Spike Lee, Morgan Freeman, and Will Packer. He has a new book. It's called Black Magic: What Black Leaders Learned from Trauma and Triumph. I think you're going to enjoy this interview.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Chad Sanders, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Kelly. It's good to be here.
At the very end of your book, Black Magic, you write, quote, "This is not a book about God or religion, and I don't care whether or not you believe in either. This is a book about belief. The moment we cease to believe, not in God or religion or spirits or heritage, but in the very tangible and useful skills we have learned from suffering since slavery, then we are hopeless," end quote. This framing sounds a lot like a combination of what the social scientists call post-traumatic growth and what Friedrich Nietzsche, his famous quote, "That which does not kill us makes us stronger." Does that ring with you?
It absolutely does. And I wish you'd told me that before I wrote the book. I would have referenced both of those. It certainly does resonate. You know, the reason why I wrote Black Magic was because it is fabled in, you know, the Black community that we have adapted and evolved through certain traumas, most specifically slavery, to learn how to do everything from, you know, cook certain meals, to communicate in certain ways, to solve math problems in creative and unique ways, to, you know, communicate over long distances. And I think that now, even today in modern society, and I think especially today in some ways, you know, we have found mechanisms to adapt to the current climate of systemic racism, racism as it exists in corporate environments. And I think that those two things are linked. In the book, you know, I go and I interview 15 people. I interviewed 200, but 15 were willing to go on record. And those people share with me the ways that since childhood, they have endured traumas in this country that have informed the ways that they do their business. That goes for everybody from a pastor of a small church in Brooklyn to the CEO of a large media company to, you know, one of the leaders of the Black Lives Matter movement, you know, to the head of startups at Google right now. So it certainly resonates. And I think there's something that all people can learn from these stories about adapting from trauma, about evolving through trauma, and using the tools that you develop in trauma to find success in whatever it is that you set your mind to.
Yeah, and this is something that I don't know if it's just white Americans who haven't dealt with trauma, or largely all, probably more, that, I mean, you face some really ugly truths in this book, but you come out the other end with sort of love and positivity and strength. And I think people have a difficulty knowing that those two things do live side by side in humanity broadly.
Yeah, they do. You know, I think about many things in this world and in this universe that feel like opposites in my, from my point of view. They generally live right next to each other on a circular spectrum, not to sound or speak too visually about that. You know, my story, as I see it, is as compared to some of the stories of the other folks in this book and some, and many of the other people that I know, it is one of the least traumatic, right? I grew up in a household with both parents college educated, you know, lower middle class to middle class, depending on who you ask. There was food on the table. There were books on the shelves, you know, went to piano lessons and basketball practice, and lived in a relatively safe suburban society. And even still, you know, before I graduated from high school, I witnessed a murder outside of my high school. Even still, you know, I had to sort of learn to live with a certain amount of fear every time I got into a car, every time I went for a drive and saw police drive by, you know, every time I had to make a decision about which houses in the neighborhood I could go in and which ones I couldn't go in. But if I, in my point of view, if, and this was something that was always hammered in by my parents, you know, especially my dad, he wanted to instill in me that if I lived my entire life in fear, and if I lived my entire life always dreading what was the next shoe to drop for me, as we can be wont to do, you know, watching the news and knowing what goes on for people that look like us, that wouldn't really be a life worth living at all. And that would be the ultimate failure to me, is to let the atrocities and the traumas that surround us take over my emotional state, take over my mentality, you know, make me feel so defeated that I wouldn't try to become an author, that I wouldn't try to write screenplays, that I wouldn't try to build a media company, you know, things that I dreamed of, acting, making music, you know, also just normal everyday things, Kelly, like going to coffee with a friend, walking my dog, you know, going out with my girlfriend. If I let sort of things that I didn't ask for, things that we didn't ask for, if I let things that just befell us take over those everyday moments and suck them away from me, then that to me is the ultimate failure. And that's not an option at all. You know, that's not a life worth living.
Yeah. In my field of improvisation, what we know is that people don't successfully improvise when they're in fear. And when they're sad, that is actually, it's a very sort of affirmative practice. And when we apply it, when we teach it to organizations or other people, it's basically what we figured out is our craft is sort of human being skills and collaboration skills. And the other thing that people don't know about improvisation a lot of times is, like, there's all these rules that you need to understand that then you can, once you have them sort of inbred, you're not sort of, you know, consciously playing with them. I want you to talk, because you talked about your dad, and I love the car rules is sort of an amazing list. And can you kind of talk to us what those were that he imparted to you and why?
Oh yeah. And I, you know, I remember them, like, I remember my birthday, no hats in the car, no more than one passenger in the passenger seat, or I guess no more than one passenger in the car along with me. Keep the radio at a medium to low volume. If I get pulled over, you know, hands on the steering wheel, yes, sir, no, sir. Just whatever I can do to very specifically maintain my freedom and maintain my life through that interaction. And I think, you know, my dad was teaching me that in the early 90s. I was born in 88. So this was probably, he probably started teaching me these rules around the time I was between 8 and 10 years old, well before I could drive a car.
Wow.
Because he wanted, you know, my dad is, he believes in, you know, freedom and enjoying your life. You know, my dad is he's a lawyer, but you'd be surprised. He's a very, very free spirit. And he believes in doing whatever you have to do to maintain your freedom. And those were the rules that he was teaching me then that I came to see over the next 20 years, all the different ways that if those rules are violated, it can cost you your life, unfortunately, in this country. You know, I think about some of the other people in the book as well. You know, Ed Bailey, who used to be my mentor at Google, who talks about neighborhood rules that he had, that his father up in Chicago, where he was living, you know, in the hood, taught him, you don't look at certain people a certain way. You don't go in the other guy's houses. You don't get into a car with another guy. You know, there's a laundry list of them. And no matter where you go all over this country, you'll find Black families that have different versions of these rules for their kids. And it's just to maintain the most simple, it's just to uphold the most simple thing that any one of us could want, which is to live and to live freely so that we might even have a chance to get where we're going.
All right. We just interviewed Fred Dust for the podcast. He's got a great new book called Making Conversation. He's a former IDEO guy. And one of the sections of the book he talks about is he's basically bemoaning the fact that families don't sit down and have dinner together. And often when you walk into houses, you'll see the dinner table is basically, you know, a desk at this point. And I grew up, I'm the youngest of six boys. We all were home for dinner. We had conversation. And you learn some shit at the dinner table that was very impressive in terms of those business rules. I mean, I wrote down a few of these. The rules of business you learn at the dinner table. Money controls all important decisions. The closer you sit to the money, the more valuable and safe you will be as an employee. Someone somewhere in account is accounting for you as a human with a dollar amount attached to your name. These are profoundly smart and insightful ideas.
Thanks, Kelly. I'll say thanks on behalf of my mom, who really was the one that brought those rules to the table.
She should write a book.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, she might. So the dinner table, it's so important. And you just said it. The dinner table is one of many human interaction points that we're losing as a society, that we are willingly giving away to spend more time with our devices. As I wrote this book, and many of these conversations happened in person, and I'm thankful because it was rehashed for me just how much you learn from body language, from intonation, from even like the slightest flick of the hair or a look in the opposite direction or a nervous laugh. Every single night we had dinner as a family. It was non-negotiable. It was, if you're going to sleep over at a friend's house, you're going after dinner. If you have basketball practice, we'll wait until you're done. If there's piano lessons tonight, you know, we will find a way to have a meal together, with very, very few exceptions. And my mom, who was an executive at Verizon at the time, my mom was an executive at Verizon for about 30 years from business school until not too long ago. She would come and, you know, instead of taking it to a friend or picking up the phone or going to a life coach or whatever, you know, all the fancy stuff that we have now, my mom would come to dinner and, you know, we would sit down, we would maybe turn on some light music and we would talk. I being a 6-year-old, my sister being a 9-year-old, and my dad sitting there with us, and we would all talk about whatever it was that was going on at work for her, whether there was someone had gotten newly promoted that was her new boss and she needed to figure out how to navigate the politics of that, whether it was Verizon had just done a new merger or acquisition and she needed to figure out where she sat in the business now and where was the most strategic place for her to move. And she and my father, they would lay these very real, very adult business problems there bare on the table. And we as children would pick at them the way that you would think about a game. And then my sister and I started to learn and developed an understanding of these rules that my parents would teach us, like the ones that you just read, such that when I got into the business world, first at Google and then, you know, at a tech startup and now running my own media company, these are things that are now second nature for me. And I did make the mistake when I started working at Google. I did make the mistake of thinking and believing that this was personal and not business, that I should bring my emotion and I should bring my passion and I should attach my personal self-worth to my business outcomes at this large corporation. And I had to revert back to what I learned at that dinner table, which was that this is just a game. You know, this is just a very impersonal, very cold and in some ways very reductive game that often reduces down to big bank, take little bank. And once I wrapped my brain back around that, then I was able to understand how the rules were set up and how the playing field was set up such that I could bring passion and energy and joy and empathy and humanity back to the work that I was doing, but more under my own terms.
Yeah, that's I think the reason I didn't find it cynical, because it's true. But then because what you end up doing is recognizing you had to play by those rules when you're inside that system. And many of the people you talk to then are like, I'm going to create my own system. I'm going to create my own rules for my thing. And ultimately, I think that sense of agency is where the real power lies.
I agree with you, Kelly. I think that if you want to understand a company culture, and it's hard to do because these people hide, find out who sits on the board at that company. Look at a picture of that. Look at a picture of that board. Research what they do in their private lives, not in their private lives, but research what they do for fun. Research what other businesses they own. Research where they went to college. Research where they grew up. Research their families. And you'll start to have a better sense of why the company culture is so. I have a lot of conversations with heads of HR, heads of people operations, heads of inclusion, heads of diversity. You know, I go and do these talks with the people that run these parts of different businesses. And one of their greatest complaints is there's a huge divide between what the people who work for the company want to see in terms of the company culture and what these people on these boards and what the people in the C-suites at these companies actually believe in. Mm-hmm. And they feel stuck at the intersection of those two things. And there's two tensions that are pulling opposite directions. But the people who write the checks and the people who have equity in the company are always going to win over. And so whatever those folks look like, that's what the company culture is going to look like. And so you're absolutely right, Kelly. A lot of these people, they did their best to learn quickly at really big, really successful companies how to build a business and how to run a company. And then they went off and did it at their own. And I say this to people all the time, you know, you can make $1 million on your own with really diligent business principles and a product or service that you are good at and really care about a lot faster on your own than you ever can working at a big corporation. That's just the way that this thing's built.
Yeah. Shareholder capitalism is a bitch. So the thing about this book is you tell your story and then you interview all these other folks. And one of the things, there's themes that crop up, and school and education was one of those. And to my very first remarks, that it has the twin power of just terrible stories and also some liberating stories. And I found a Ta-Nehisi Coates quote where he says, quote, "The classroom was a jail of other people's interests. The library was open, unending, and free." And the library could also be an HBCU based on the conversations in the book that these people who went to these largely white schools and really sort of suffered. One of your folks even says that maybe it was Morehouse, where they said they could finally breathe. So talk to us a bit about what you discovered through those conversations and your own experience.
Yeah. You know, Ta-Nehisi Coates's language is probably stronger than what I would use to call it a jail. But it is certainly a classroom, and especially a classroom where you are one of very few people who share your identity. It can be a very restrictive experience, and it can be a place where you feel like you have to put on a certain voice, you have to put on certain clothes, you have to put on even certain opinions and identities to share voice in the room, to have the conch at any time, you know, to even be able to answer a question, to be able to, you know, speak your opinion at any given point. You feel like you have to emulate whatever is the larger body of the room. Many, almost to a person, I think people talked about going to HBCUs or going to Black student unions within predominantly white institutions, or, you know, playing on sports teams or being a part of acting groups or whatever the case may be, where they found more Black people. The folks that I interviewed in my book, they talked about physically being able to breathe, being able to open up space for themselves, being able to sit in a comfortable posture. You know, anytime you're in a place that is uncomfortable, where you feel less welcomed, it affects your body. You know, there's people study this now. There's a lot of books coming out about the ways that trauma impacts your physicality and the ways that it impacts your brain, the ways that it impacts your body. And these folks spoke very specifically with detail about walking into that cafeteria at Howard for the first time, as an example, and just being able to, that's a big, if you've never felt it before, if you've only felt it in rooms with family, or if you've only felt it in, you know, small rooms with friends, it's a life-changing experience to be in a place that is full of people that look like you, but still with such diversity, and to be able to just really truly bring your whole self, not in the way that it's marketed by HR organizations.
Yeah, the trauma research is fascinating. And I'm very familiar with Bessel van der Kolk's work about trauma living in the body. And then sort of recent studies that show that trauma goes back sometimes 7 generations at least. I mean, that is historically, and that is for all people, but Black Americans in particular, under the yoke of slavery, it isn't over by any stretch. And you write in the book, quote, "I was always engaged in cultural battles on top of my coursework." So that's a kind of double bind that I don't think people give a lot of consideration for.
Yeah, that's right, Kelly. And it's that experience of feeling like everything you do, every movement you make, every word you say, it has such a pressure on it because you feel like you are representing an entire body of people who are not there. You know, for me, it was in middle school being in gifted and talented programs where I would be one of the only 2 Black kids. And every question that goes up or every conversation that comes up, I feel like I have to give my personal opinion, but I also have to give some sort of like political speech damn near that represents the opinions of everybody that looks like me that's not in the room. And also you said something important, and it's an important point I meant to make throughout this book, which is that that's not a unique experience to Black people. That's an experience to anybody that isn't a part of the dominant representative group, wherever that might be, you know. So that is an experience for women in a lot of situations in the tech industry, that's in the finance industry and in many industries. That's an experience for people of Latin backgrounds. That's an experience for people who are gay. That's an experience for, you know, so many different people who have to walk into a place and feel like while everybody else gets to have nuance and subtlety and their own personal point of view that only represents what they're bringing, that these people, the people who are marginalized, have to come in and speak for everybody else that's not in the room. It's daunting. And then to, on top of that, also try to know your times tables is really
Yeah. Right, which is hard enough. We had a recent podcast with Carl Bergstrom, who has a great book called Calling Bullshit. And it's just basically a history of bullshit. And there's a whole middle section. We couldn't cover it that much because it was mostly about design bullshit. And the map is a big one in there. And in your interview with the activist DeRay McKesson, he says, quote, "When you think about the map that is used in the vast majority of classrooms in this country, it makes all the continents look proportionate in size when Africa is actually just much bigger than the rest of the continents besides Asia. We should teach the true history." I mean, this map is like an original lie, one of many original lies. But I mean, it's so stark because it hasn't changed to today as far as I'm not seeing the real map anywhere.
No, and that's, Kelly, to your point, I think there's a certain institutional laziness that we have about the ways that some things are taught. And I do think it's very much related to capitalism, which is such that capitalism, or in this particular country, we don't pay teachers very well. We don't pay people to do overtime on fighting the battles to change the ways that things are taught. And we have people that do it, who do it selflessly as a fight of passion and of love, but they don't necessarily always have the vehicles behind them and the machine behind them you got to produce textbooks. And in this day and age, you got to produce and distribute online learning. This isn't free stuff. Like somebody has to pay for that. Someone has to foot the bill for that. And they have to feel like they're going to have some kind of return on that investment, unless they're just doing it out of the kindness and goodness of their heart. So in this particular situation, it's such that we have a map that's distorted. But we also have, you know, textbooks that are distorted. I mentioned in my book, one of my teachers, and I'm not going to get the exact quote right because I don't have it here in front of me, but she remarked that, you know, slavery was an economically advantageous, but
I have it.
Convenient truth.
I wrote it down. It is that slavery was a, quote, "economically savvy historical inconvenience."
Yeah. And that was how slavery was presented to me when I was, I think, 11 years old. Maybe that was in fifth grade or fourth grade or whatever it was. And, you know, society is weird. Anthropology is weird, right? We will just pass along something as true without challenging it. We do it all day, every day, because mm-hmm. we have to get to the next moment. There's other things that are urgent and that are pressing. And if that's not the thing for you, you just go ahead and spit it off into the ears of 25, 11-year-olds. And then they take that on and they take it home, and it becomes whatever it becomes. But I think, to the larger point, yeah, we have misinformation in this world that needs to be corrected.
And I think at a basic human level, one of the reasons we have these problems is people are just too scared to make a comment that will make the room uncomfortable. And a lot of this podcast, when we examine the rules around improvisation, it's very much about becoming comfortable with your discomfort. And that is a theme overwhelmingly in your conversations. Of this is actually it's a superpower when you are able to enter and like live in this discomfort. And I think you sort of point that out when you I have the quote here. You said something about I remember the day I realized I couldn't play a white guy as well as a white guy. Would be a very great statement. But then when you started speaking your truth, you actually that was successful for you.
Yeah. Well. Comfort with discomfort is absolutely a superpower. It is one form of black magic that I think many other people also share. To speak to the equation that I believe in, you know, to create wealth, you have to have equity. To create equity or to have equity, you have to build a business. And to build a business, if you build a business, you're an entrepreneur. And great entrepreneurs are very, very comfortable with discomfort. They are very, very comfortable entering a space where they don't have experience. They're very comfortable asking for an amount of money that might sound absurd coming out of their mouths. They're very comfortable getting on the ground and selling products and services themselves that might feel beneath certain people who have prestigious degrees and LinkedIn pages. So comfort with discomfort is probably my favorite superpower as listed in the book that so many Black people share. And that comfort is born through, you know, living with less money than our white counterparts. Black people have a median wealth of under $5,000, I think, compared to $97,000 for white families. Yep. That's about 5%. So just imagine how it feels to walk around in a company, in a classroom, on a campus where you know that most of the people around you have 20 times more money than you do. That's really uncomfortable. That creates a lot of really uncomfortable environments when you go to social situations and people are buying drinks, you know, at the company happy hour, and you know what you have in your bank account and you know what they have in theirs. So you have an idea, right? That's discomfort. That can be transferred. You know, that sort of comfort can be used. It can be turned into entering spaces and walking with an ease and talking with a certain confidence that can get you places as you build a business. And that's what I'm trying to speak to there.
So the, speaking your truth is important, but you have an interview with Letitia Thomas who says a different thing, where she says, quote, "Your words have power, but so does your silence." So I think it's important to recognize that that duality is true as well.
Yeah. And specifically, I think, especially in corporate environments, now in this day and age, where companies are sort of tepidly trying to have conversations about diversity and inclusion and race and trauma and history, there is, again, this moment that occurs in a meeting where you are the only, and a conversation comes up that is uncomfortable, and you feel all the eyes in the room sort of find their way over to you. And you are expected to speak as the spokesperson for all Black people or all Asian people or all gay people or all, you know, transgender people, whatever the case may be. You don't have to wear that responsibility. You know, that's a choice. And your silence, your choosing your battles, is a point of strategy, and it's a point of energy conservation, and it's a point of also learning, you know, you can learn how to say something without saying anything. And it can be very powerful. Just as Leticia says, it's up to each of us individually to decide when and where to use our voices. And sometimes the space between the notes makes the music.
I love that. In a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story. But I love a quote you give to Spike Lee, who you've partnered with, where and this is when you're going and pitching a show and like everyone's saying no, which is I've lived that reality. And he says, quote, "This business is about failure." And this is something that comes up all the time here, which is just like, I think it would be great if we all just admit that we all fail more than we succeed. And so normalizing failure takes a hell of a lot of the pressure off.
Yeah, that and a way to do that is to take a lot of shots. You're going to miss so many. You know, the way to do that is by volume. When he said that to me, I had not developed a thick skin yet. At that time, just to paint the picture, Spike and I were pitching my first TV series. And, you know, everyone wear a smile about it. You know, everyone's charming. Everybody's sweet about it. But sure. They kept slamming the door, mostly in my face, not in his. He won an Oscar the next year. So It was, for me, that experience of this thing that I considered to be my baby. And you know how this is, Kelly. It was like, I felt like I had bled out on the page. And These were like my most precious thoughts and feelings. And this was how I saw the world. And Netflix, Amazon, HBO, you know, everybody. No thanks, no thanks, no thanks, no thanks. Those voices, those no's were keeping me up at night. They were the first thing I heard in the morning, you know, in my own head. They were what followed me onto the subway, walking around Brooklyn, you know, going back. At that point, I was living in a studio apartment, 250 square feet on a mattress on the floor. You know, I had quit my job. Like things were bleak. And I was surprised. You know, I had bought into the marketing version of what Hollywood looks like, which is, oh, you write this thing and, oh my God, Spike Lee picks it up. You take it out to Hollywood, you turn around and you're a millionaire. And instead, what I found was I was getting bludgeoned by no's. And now so many pitches and projects and, you know, and honestly failures and no's later, just in the last 4 years, you almost don't notice at a certain point. And you only kind of focus on the door that needs to open. And I think so many Black people can relate to that experience, you know, when it comes to trying to join a club, trying to get into a certain college, trying to get a recommendation by a professor who, you know, really doesn't have your back like that. If you can get comfortable with just letting the no's and the failures and the no thankses and the smiling, you know, fuck offs, just like roll off your back, the doors that open are all you need. You just need one. They all go into the same house. You just need one door to open to walk in. So I think that's the point I was trying to make there.
It's a hard muscle to develop. And because we kind of have to manufacture it. I forget the guy's name, but he did this project where he basically every day asked for something that was essentially impossible. So he would ask a cop to go shoot his gun, or he would, you know, ask to go serve ice cream. And then the amazing thing is, like, every once in a while, someone said yes, and he just did it. But he was trying to break this pattern of, you know, letting that stuff sort of just, you know, kill you. And you know, what my wife is a comedy professor. She runs the first BA in comedy writing performance in the country at Columbia College. And what she tries to instill, especially in her freshmen, is this basically get your stuff out, have a writing practice. I don't care if it's 5 minutes every day, but it's just like, it's hard for these kids to learn to hit send. They don't want to put something out that's not fully baked. It's like, no, you've got to put out stuff that's not, nothing's ever fully baked. And when you realize that, and you can just sort of, it's such a, the burden is so, it's such a relief when you realize, oh no, I can just throw my stuff out in the world. And this book feels like that's a spirit of a lot of what's going on in here.
Oh yeah. I mean, you're talking about my favorite thing now. At the time, it was so scary because your identity's wrapped in it. You know, you're telling yourself, For instance, if these are writing students, they're telling themselves that what they're going to bed with every night is, I've tried my best here, and it's here. And if I send this to somebody and they either don't read it, don't respond to it, read it, only get halfway through, read it and give me some kind of like margin. The thing is, nobody's going to reply to you. I know the woman, I can see her face. The one person ever who I sent something who replied and said, this is shit. And I knew it was shit. This was 10 years ago, right? But almost nobody is going to respond and say, no, this is bad. But what hurts even more is no response, not finishing it.
Yeah.
Or in the case of, you know, sometimes buyers, you know, studios, networks, they got to say no if it's a no. They can't just leave it lingering forever. That hurts, right? But there is something that there's this nirvana that can, there's like this euphoria that can overtake you about just shooting shots, just pressing send, just getting things going. You put them in the universe. They're not you anymore. Once you've written it, once it's a PDF, it's not you anymore. The book I stand behind it, but I stand behind it. It's its own thing now. Black Magic has its own life. It has its own words on the pages. It's not me. It's not like it's not an audition tape. You know what I mean? So you have to, and I think it's especially hard for young people because life over time, even if it's not about your art, you're going to fail at so much. You're going to fail in relationships. You're going to fail financially. You're going to fail at raising your kids. You're going to I think the older that you get, you know, life's going to smack you around regardless. But while we're still young and kind of guarded and protected, and we've gone through this process of grade school, college, early entry program at something, whatever thing, you know, there's always somebody there kind of like keeping the real world off you a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But the moment you press send on something that you care about to someone who doesn't know you, you know, you're out there in the wild, but then you can just live out there in the wild for the rest of your life. And you'll be surprised. We're animals. We can adapt. We'll figure it out. So you're speaking my language.
So we talked about no, so that's a good pivot to my last question, which will be for a yes and story. So in the parlance of improvisation, when groups of people are making something out of nothing, they get nowhere by saying no. And they actually don't get that far by saying yes. We say you say yes and. Do you have a yes and story for us?
I do. And you mentioned this person's name earlier. He's a big part of my story, mainly in that he instilled confidence for me more than anything. But I left Google in 2014. I went to work at a tech startup. I left that tech startup in 2016. I wasn't representing it this way to my parents, but I was more or less just sort of jobless, wandering, figuring out what I was going to do. And I had, you know, a dream to make this TV series. I Googled how to write a TV pilot. Hmm. I hacked together a TV pilot. And I was sitting outside of the coffee shop where I was writing it, kind of taking like a little break, little thought break. And I looked across, this was in Fort Greene at this coffee shop called Baba Cool. It was probably like summer. And I looked across the promenade and I saw sitting there, I guess reading his paper, scrolling his BlackBerry phone, it was Spike Lee. And Spike's 40 Acres and a Mule Studios right across the street from Baba Cool there. So I guess he was out for a coffee break himself. And, you know, this is sort of a spiritual answer to the question.
Mm-hmm.
There are these moments, you know, sometimes it's when you first see your soulmate for the first time. Sometimes it's when you see an opportunity. Sometimes it's, you know, thinking about buying a pet. You know, there are these moments where you're like, well, there is the person that I need to meet. But am I really ready to go and meet this person? And you can kind of feel, I'll put it in my own language, like I could feel God behind me kind of like giving me a little bump. But I had to decide in that moment. And frankly, it didn't feel much like a decision, but I had to say, yes, I will go introduce myself to Spike Lee. I don't know what I'm going to say to him. And I did. And the end was once we had our conversation, once we started talking, you know, and I said, hey, I'm Chad. I went to Morehouse. And he goes, hey, my Morehouse brother, blah, blah, blah. He was very welcoming. He was not at all the way that some people describe Spike as this like prickly and, you know, spicy person. And he was very welcoming. He talked to me for 30 minutes And the "and" came later, which was that I had this, he gave me his email. I had a very sort of underdeveloped, very raw, very just like, you know, hacked together screenplay, TV series pilot. And I had to decide, and I had to realize, like, this might be my only shot. Like, this might be the only time I meet somebody like this who can change everything. And I sent it to him, and he called me in. We sat at a table in his studio, and he redlined every page, and we took it out to Hollywood. And that was my first experience. He put me on my first class flight ever in my life. Mm. That was my first experience going out to Hollywood and pitching a project. And I got to do it with Spike Lee because I let the yes and happen to me. So that opened up a career, and that changed my life.
I love it. The book is called Black Magic: What Black Leaders Learned from Trauma and Triumph. Chad Sanders, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks, Kelly. I really appreciate it.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is L.F. Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Survive.